This is where normal comes to die. Mediocrity meets its final demise, and the status quo is unabashedly dismantled. Welcome to Reinvention Radio. Now, here's your host, Steve Ulscher.
Alrighty, welcome to the edition here of Reinvention Radio. Mary Delay, hi.
Hello.
Richie O'Tay, what's up, baby?
What's going on?
And Steve Ulscher here with you. And this should be pretty interesting because are you guys familiar? First of all, do you guys read? Like, I'm not like read, like internet, like read. I mean, like physical books. Like,
yes, you do.
You still read?
I love books.
Yeah, me too.
Love
like,
them.
Are we talking fiction or nonfiction? Or what do you typically lean towards?
I would love to take the time to read more fiction, but I read a lot of nonfiction.
And you, Richie? What do you read nowadays? When you read?
I read fiction when I'm reading.
You read Playboy just for the articles,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. But the only, like...
You're so weird.
It's true.
I don't really like the self-help books anymore.
Mm-hmm. Especially what is that?
I like those in shorter, like either workshops or something. I'm not really those anymore.
I gotcha. So are you familiar with, there was let's even call it what it was, a seminal work. I just love that word. I've been trying to figure out how to work that into the show for almost 300 episodes now, but I finally did it. It's a seminal work. A seminal work called Good to Great. Have you seen that?
Heard that?
Yeah. Did you read it?
Part of it.
Yeah, me neither. did you read it, Rich? No. You can tell by the way I'm operating my company. It's still good. It's getting towards great. Not quite there yet, but it's getting there. So I'm excited because basically, when you were in high school, did you ever do like Cliff Notes? You know, just instead of reading the whole thing, or whatever.
Yes,
the Cliff Note. Yeah,
did you do that?
Okay, good. So we all kind of did that. So there's a gentleman by the name of Michael Bungestanier. I'm probably just totally butchering, and he's going to tell me in about 28 seconds here how much I butchered his name. But I'm hoping he can kind of give us the Cliff Notes here because a lot of what he does is about helping people do less good work and more great work. And so maybe we'll get a little bit of the Cliff Notes here. So actually, Wade, let's bring Michael up. So first and foremost, tell us how to pronounce your name because I'm sure I butchered it. How do you say your name?
Well, Steve, I've got to tell you, it's not the worst pronunciation of my name I've ever had. I once got introduced as Michael Banging Spaniel, which was basically a low point in terms of name pronunciation. So you were close. It's Michael Bungay Stanier.
Oh, okay.
I was
at least on the right page as far as...
You were trending in the right direction.
As far as my phonetic pronunciation is concerned. All right. So tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do, because love the name of your website, by the way, boxofcrayons.biz. That's probably the funnest URL I've heard in a long time. Box of crayons.
Thanks, Steve.
And these are the edible crayons or the non-edible. I just want to make sure I know what kind of crayons
we swing both ways on that. whatever you need, we can do for you. Yeah,
it's the pendulum. All right, and so tell us a little bit about who you are. I mean, as I said, you've done a number of different things in the arena here of coaching and helping people do more great work and less good work. I know you've got a book out called "Do More Great Work," appropriately enough. And then you've got another book called The Coaching Habit and so on. Yeah. So give us a quick overview of who you are and what you do.
Here's the rapid thing. So Box of Crayons, my company, I'm the founder. Just as you said, we help people and organizations do less good work and do more great work. And we can talk a bit more about that and unpack it a little bit. It's got a really nice connection to the What Is Your What piece for sure. But a little bit about me. So I'm Australian by birth. I have ended up living in Canada. So I've sat there and listened to your 10 minutes about Thanksgiving, completely not understanding anything what you're talking about.
That's
so
funny.
It's a bit of a mystery to me. But about 25 years ago, I was a Rhodes Scholar, so I headed off to England, and studying at Oxford did two brilliant things for me. Number one, it stopped me becoming a lawyer because I had a law degree in Australia. But honestly, that was going bad. I had actually left my law school being sued by one of my own law lecturers for defamation.
Oh, my God.
So it's probably a clue that wasn't the right career path for me. That was not my what. Let's just say that. The other great thing about studying at Oxford was I met my Canadian wife, which is why I now face a Canadian winter thinking, what am I doing here? I could be in Australia right now, but that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
when I finally got out of university, I spent some years in the world of innovation and creativity. So I can claim to have played a small role in helping to invent stuffed crust pizza for Pizza Hut.
Nice.
Well, you know, as a moment where I'm like, that's amazing. And then I went, you know what, if this is actually my career high point, it's a pretty low point. I don't want to die as the man who helped invent stuffed crust pizza. There's got to be more to it than that.
Yeah, especially since the guy who just invented the Big Mac just died. So, I mean, you know, and then everything goes in threes, man. So this may actually be your last interview. Hey. Thanks for joining us here on Reinvention Radio.
Thank you. You know, I'm not feeling that well. Maybe it's the salmonella kicking in. Who knows?
It could be day six of turkey that you know
that's
nothing about.
Right. That's right. So after innovation and creativity, I spend time in the world of trying to figure out why organizations work and why they don't work. So that kind of organizational change piece. And then when I moved up to Canada 15 years ago, we started Box of Crayons. And our broad mission, how do you help people and organizations do less good work and more great work? And by great work, I'm saying the work that has more impact and also the work that has more meaning. So right up your area, Steve. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we've got a real focus now about practical coaching skills for busy people. So coaching is one of the most powerful ways of helping people figure out what their what is, what their great work might be. Because what it's about is about leading with curiosity rather than rushing in with advice and suggestions on what to do, which is what we all want to do, but often doesn't actually help as much as we think it might.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so just so I'm clear here, what there's a difference, but I think I don't want to read between the lines here. I want you to actually explain it in your own words. What is the difference then between good work and, as you put it, great work? What are some of the differences?
Yeah, so here's how I think about it. I think everything you do, whether it's at your career or your life outside work, actually falls into one of three different buckets: bad work, good work, or great work. So bad work, and I'll just be blunt in the interest of time, bad work is that mind-numbing, soul-sucking, life-crushing, I want to stab myself in the eye with a plastic fork sort of work. You know, that work where you sit there going, well, this is my one and precious life, and somehow I am doing this. What the hell just happened? Mm. Right? That's bad work. Mm-hmm. And I've yet to meet anybody who doesn't know exactly what I'm talking about when I describe that. The fastest way to describe good work is to simply say it's your job description. Now, that might you might have an official job description, you might have an unofficial job description, but basically it's what your boss wants you to do, it's what your boss's boss wants you to do, it's what you can do well because you've been doing it for years so you don't screw it up too often, and it's productive, it's efficient, it's getting things done. So it plays a really important part in our lives. But the challenge is that most of us have just too much good work. We're spending our whole time battling the inbox, battling the in-tray, battling the routine of life. And even as we strive to do it, and we might be feeling stressed or a bit busy about it, somehow when we're doing good work, we're a little bit stuck in our own comfortable rut. You know, it's no longer us stretching and growing and pushing ourselves. And then the third type of work is great work. And, you know, this is the piece where we have that strong connection with what is your what, which is the work that has more impact. So it's the work that makes a difference. But it's also the work that has more meaning. It's the work who speaks to who you are, what matters in the world, what impact you're looking to do, what's the gift you're looking to bring forth into the world. And you're looking to find that combination of impact and meaning, and that's the great work piece.
Mm-hmm. And just out of curiosity, in the companies that you work with and the consulting, and you've been in this game now for quite some time, on average, let's look at it from, as Rich would say, a macro perspective. So from a macro perspective, how many companies, I guess as a percentage out of 10 companies, how many are really doing great work out there right now? What number would you throw on that?
Well, you know, I think the goal you have as a company or an individual or even as a team is, do we have the right mix between good work and great work? That's the challenge you're looking to find. What's the perfect mix between the work that keeps things ticking over, keeps things moving forward, keeps delivering reliable service and products or whatever to our people, but also where's the work that stretches us, grows us, blue ocean strategy makes a difference? And that's what's elusive. And when you, because I ask people this all the time, I get them to kind of do a little self-rating about how much bad work, how much good work, how much great work they're currently doing. Most people say, look, I've got somewhere between 0 and 30% bad work. I've got somewhere between 20 and 80% good work. And I've got somewhere between 0 and, I'm going to say, 30% great work. Mm. But it varies, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. Here's the question that really is interesting. When you ask people, who has too much great work right now? Too much of the work that makes a difference, much of the work that has real impact. Who's looking to shed some of that? Basically, I've asked 50,000 people that question. Only two people have ever stuck up their hand. And I'm pretty sure they didn't really understand the question. You know, everybody's got a hunger to do more of that great work. It's mm-hmm. just trying to find it and start it and have the courage to sustain it. That's where the challenge lies.
Yeah.
So I'd like to ask a question about the meaning and impact on a corporate level. Boy, okay, we're going to have to ask fast. We're coming up to a break in just less than a minute. And maybe it has to go into the next segment, because the meaning and impact on a corporate level, do you see people transform when that concept is even tossed out at them?
Yeah, I think it happens twofold, Mary. I think, first of all, you get people kind of getting back to who they are and what they want to stand for in the world, rather than kind of having the life sucked out of them a bit. But what really becomes interesting is when teams start to transform, because great work can be a great unifying feature for the team that says, what difference are we going to make here within our organization? Because organizations sometimes feel too big. I'm a small person. My organization's huge. What difference can I make? But when you get into a team level, things can really start to be interesting, because then they go, we're a small unit. We're flexible to be fast and agile, but we've got enough critical mass to support each other to be courageous enough to do this great work.
Yeah, that's really, really good. All right, lots of things that I know I've got on my my notes here to go over with Michael, and I'm looking forward to getting some of these questions answered, including, I know you've got the best 7 questions, and you got all sorts of interesting things around that, but I know you've got big questions that can be answered here in terms of how you shift from doing good work and doing more great work. So more with Michael Bungay-Stunier here on Reinvention Radio right after this.
You were born to do one amazing thing, but most people spend a lifetime trying to identify what it is. If you're at a job you don't like or are unemployed, if you're in a state of transition or just can't shake that nagging feeling that you were meant and made to do something extraordinary, the Reinvention Workshop is exactly what you need. Led by award-winning self-help author Steve Ulcher, the Reinvention Workshop will forever change your life. The Reinvention Workshop takes you step by step through Steve's proven formula that has helped so many get on the right path and be clear about what they were born to do. Take the first step for realizing the life you deserve and desire by visiting TheReinventionWorkshop.com today. No more delays, no more denial. Reconnect with your true self. Learn to live with purpose and conviction and become who you were born to be. The world is waiting for you. What are you waiting for? Log on to TheReinventionWorkshop.com. That's TheReinventionWorkshop.com.
Talk to me.
Information, news, and entertainment on demand.
WSRadio.com.
And now, back to Reinvention Radio. Here's your host, Steve Ulcher.
Alrighty, welcome back to another edition here of Reinvention Radio. We're hanging out, Mary Gallet Richotte.
Hi. Hello.
And we got Michael Bungay-Stunier on the line with us, and I think I'm closer now, so that is good. There was one guy who I forget who it was, but I totally butchered. I got to go back through the archives and look at that name, because that name I absolutely butchered, and he hasn't spoken to me since. So hopefully Michael and I will still be friends by the end of this episode. All right, so let me ask you this: just trying to get my arms around exactly what you mean by coaching, and you're saying that everybody is ostensibly a coach to people that they work with. Is that what you mean by this, or are you saying something else?
Yeah, you know, that's why it's so great to be talking to you on this show, because I've got a kind of flea in my head around the whole way coaching shows up in this world. Because when you say to people coaching, people come with a kind of a package in their head. They go, okay, it's life coaching. So full of kind of incense and pastel colors and muzak, or maybe it's executive coaching, which is kind of suited and in the office and kind of high level only, or maybe it's some other type of coaching. But for me, coaching is actually not really a profession so much as a way of showing up with each other. And it's not really about trying to turn people into coaches, because there's enough of those already in the world. I'm sure many of them are doing a great job. It's really about helping people be more coach-like with each other. And what that means, Steve, when it boils down to it, because it's simple but it's difficult, is to say, how can you stay more curious with people a little bit longer? And how can you rush to advice and action just a little bit slower? Because here's the thing. Most of us are advice-giving maniacs. I mean, we love it. Like somebody starts talking to us, we don't really know them. We don't know really what the problem is. But after 20 seconds, we're like, okay, just shut up because I'm about to tell you what to do. And I'm just trying to slow that pace down, stay curious just a little bit longer so that when your advice comes, if it even needs to come, it actually lands with a bit more impact. So in that sense, absolutely, I think everybody you work with, you can be a bit more coach-like with, not just in conversation, but over email and text, whatever it might be.
Yeah, it's helpful. Mary, did you have, or Richard, you're jumping out of your chair.
Yeah.
Well, it was, I love the concept. I really love the concept. What I'm interested in is, what does the sales process look like when you have that as your mode of operation? Like, it could take a long time to get through the sales process, I'm assuming, too, because you're trying to figure out a lot about the people.
Well, here's the thing with, you know, when you're in a sales process, you look at what great salespeople do is they don't rush in to start telling you about their product. Because that's the classic sales 101 blunder. Oh, I've got this thing. Let me tell you how awesome the widgets and the benefits and the this and the that are. And actually what you're often doing is you're just talking to a stone wall because they don't really care. But if you can lead a conversation with curiosity, get into a conversation about what they're really up against, what their real challenge is, what they really want, then you're going to be in such a much stronger position when it comes to it, when you go, well, if that's at the heart of it for you, if that's your real challenge, if that's what you're up against, well, then look, I might have something for you that could actually help here. So there's a really strong parallel between the best salespeople and the best coaches because they all lead with curiosity, knowing that there's a place for advice or guidance or making the sale, but the longer you can wait, the more interesting a place you're likely to pop up into.
Is there something you notice where it tips over to where it's time? And I'm not, I know you're trying to slow it down and I'm not trying to speed it back up, but I'm just curious as, because I would try to stay in asking questions as long as possible, but you don't want to stay there forever, right? You still want to get ask. So is there something, a transition point that you see kind of universally? I know you want to consult people individually, but.
Yeah, so here's the pattern that I notice. There's a question that I think is fundamental. It's the, you know, you said there are seven core questions in the book, and there are, and this is question number three. It's called the focus question. And the focus question is, what's the real challenge here for you? And it's extremely powerful because it doesn't just ask, what's the challenge? And it doesn't even ask, what's the real challenge? It says, what's the real challenge here for you? So it both deepens it and personalizes the conversation. And it's so tempting to go with the first response to that because it feels real and tangible. But what I've noticed is if you can go to another level down or maybe even a third level down, that's almost always a far more interesting place to be. So it's practice, Richard. You know, the more you do this, the more you develop an ear for going, oh, I think we've landed on something really interesting here. Mm-hmm. What's important to know is this isn't a 20-minute interrogation. This can be like 3 minutes or 4 minutes. We're not asking people to take hours staying curious. We're saying, look, stay curious just another 3 minutes. You're going to be in such a more interesting, richer, more valuable conversation for both sides of the party.
Makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, and I do want to jump into that because before the break, we talked about the seven questions. You've jumped in here with the third of the seven questions. These explain what the seven questions are, and then in just a few minutes, maybe touch on them, and then if we want to go deeper on any one of those, we will. But just explain the purpose of the seven questions, and then just kind of give us a really high-level overview of what they are.
So, Steve, you know the problem with books, writing books, reading books, is that often they're just a bit long and a bit boring. So when I started writing this book, and this is my fifth book, I was like, okay, what is the shortest book I could write that would still be useful for people? And I knew that I wanted to write about sharing some core. I spent 10 years teaching people these questions, and I knew what worked and what didn't. But honestly, when I started off, I was like, okay, maybe it's 150 questions. These are the best 150 questions in the world. I was like, okay, I wrote that book. It was terrible. And I was like, okay, what if there's just three questions? I'm like, okay, there's not enough here. And then we ended up on these seven questions. So here are the seven questions. It starts off with the first question you might ask in a conversation called the Kickstarter question. And the Kickstarter question is, what's on your mind? really powerful way of getting more quickly into a juicy conversation.
And Michael, just so I'm clear here, is this in a work environment? Is this with people personally? I just want to make sure I'm on the same page with you here.
No, it's a great question. So when I wrote the book, the person I had in mind was a busy, engaged manager or leader. Like, she's trying to do better work. She's committed to her team. She actually likes the place she works. But you know what? She's overwhelmed and she's just not having the impact that she wants. So that's who I thought about when I wrote this book. What we've heard in the year or so since it's been out is actually it just resonates for people who talk to other people.
like everybody.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Except for the Unabomber, I guess, is the only one it wouldn't be applicable for.
Right. So if you interact with human beings, there's going to be something valuable here for you in these questions that you can use to have better conversations with people.
Got it.
So the second question, the first question, the Kickstarter question, how to get into a conversation fast. The second question we claim to be best coaching question in the world, which I know is a pretty bold claim. But the question is simply, and what else? And what else is so powerful because you come to realize that the first answer somebody gives you is never their only answer. And it's rarely their best answer. So it allows you to stay curious and actually get more out of a single question. It kind of amps up any other question that you want to ask. The focus question we've covered already, what's the real challenge here for you? The foundation question, I think this is really a strong connection to what is your what. And the foundation question is, what do you want? You know, really simple question to ask, but actually a pretty hard question to answer. It really makes people kind of struggle to figure out, what is it that I really want in this moment, in this week, in this life?
And I would think inflection is probably pretty important with that particular question, because you'd be like, what do you want? Or what do you want?
Yeah, you got it.
What do you want? Right? So, like, I think it really, inflection, I think, is super important there.
You're such a dork.
Thank you.
No, but yeah, first of all, Mary, he totally is a dork. You're right there.
But he's right.
But he's actually right, which is like, you can turn any of these questions so they sound like, I don't know, drive-by questioning. You know, you're like, you don't care what the answer is. You just kind of battering somebody to death.
Rich, what is the real challenge here for you? Really?
Exactly. You got it. So tone matters. And almost what drives tone is attitude. And attitude is like, look, am I on this person's side? Do I care about what's happening in this conversation? Am I genuinely curious as to what they're saying? And if you got all of that, your tone's going to be great. If you don't have that, then your tone may go a little off the edge, just like Steve's role modeling so beautifully for us all. So three more questions to go. Number five, the lazy question. That's, how can I help? And if you want to, we can dig into that, because it's almost paradoxical to call how can I help a lazy question, but it's really fundamental to this whole approach of coaching, which is, how do you be lazy but in a good way? Number six, the strategic question. Again, a really nice link to what is your what, which is, if you're saying yes to this, what must you say no to? Because you know that there's no point in articulating what your what is, what impact you have in the world, unless you're courageous enough to say no to some of the other options so you can fully commit to how you want to show up in this world. And then the seventh and final question, the learning question. You know, part of why we are on this planet, part of why the four of us do the work we do, is to help people grow to become more full, more complete human beings. And they do that by learning. And you've got to understand how people learn. And they don't learn when you tell them stuff. They learn when they have an opportunity to reflect on what just happened. So the learning question is, what was most useful or most valuable for you here? You know, at the end of a conversation or a radio show or a workshop, it allows people to actually extract the knowledge and grow as a result.
Yeah, no, those are really, 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 really good questions. And I know, at least on my piece of paper here, I've got some notes about how I want to go a little bit deeper on that. I'm sure, Mary, you've got some questions as well, as you always do, and Richie Rich. But we're going to have to, well, coming up here on another break. So what we're going to have to do is take that break. And if you want more information about Michael and all of his books and all the work that he's doing in the world, which is really, really good work. And I guess I should say, it used to be good work, but now it's great work. So as a matter of fact, you've got to be insulted. If people say, Michael, you're doing good work in the world, that's got to be a little insulting now. So we don't want to insult our guests. So Michael's doing great work, and you can check that out at boxofcrayons.biz. So boxofcrayons.biz. All right, more with Michael here on Reinvention Radio. Mary Gwilay, Richard Tasty Volsher. We'll be back right after this.
Looking to be a successful entrepreneur? The virtual assistant industry continues to be a top choice for those looking to start their own business. The problem can be how to become a virtual assistant. Many turn to the Bible of the VA industry, the book, Virtual Assistant, the series, and it's the perfect guide for office managers, executive assistants, and other administrative professionals looking to make the transition from employee to successful business owner. Go to vatheseries.com to get your copy today.
Talk to me.
Information, news, and entertainment on demand.
WSRadio.com.
And now, back to Reinvention Radio. Here's your host, Steve Ulsher.
Alrighty, welcome back to Reinvention Radio. Hanging out with Mary Gwilay, Richard J. I'm Steve Ulsher, and we're talking to Michael Bungay-Stenier about how do we really move from just doing good work in the world to doing more great work in the world. And by the way, Michael, I will say that my my all-time favorite book from you is End Malaria. That is
thank you.
Yeah, I mean, and it has nothing to do with ending malaria, which I find to be it's titillating. Let's just say that it's a titillating title.
Did you just open the dictionary over the weekend
or
something?
I did. Titillating. Those are my. I've got like that app on my phone. It puts those words on my, you know, the screen thing, and you get these new words and
word of the day.
I'm feeling slightly dirty here. I've just got to tell you.
Seminal and titillating. All right, there we go. All right, so before the break, we were talking about the best seven questions that you can ask somebody. And so I just want to make sure I'm clear on this. And what else, Michael?
I see what you're doing there.
You like that? Is that good? Is that
funny? Yeah.
You like that? Thank you. Is that it? That's just the seven. Okay. Just want to make sure we're not missing anything. All right. So give us a couple of examples. One of the notes, questions that I have around my notes is give us a couple of examples of companies that you think are doing great work right now.
You know, what I'd say is that there's great work being done in pretty much every organization. You know, they've got a moment where they found the focus, they found the courage, they found the resilience to go, this is the thing we're going to work on. We're going to say no to the other distractions. I mean, you know, Steve Jobs so famously said, you know, effectively strategy is saying no to the stuff you kind of want to say yes to. And it's the people who've gone, right, as tempting as it is for us to put that aside, or tempting as it is to do that, we're going to put it aside. And we're going to pursue this because this is the thing that matters. This is the thing that's going to make a difference. So it honestly doesn't matter whether I'm working with, for instance, one of our clients is USAA, great financial services firm based in San Antonio. Mm-hmm. They have a real commitment to serving people who served in the military. That's it. That's their target audience. And on the one hand, they're really quite a conservative culture. They would say this themselves, that, you know, there's very strong military presence and the way they work. On the other hand, they're known in the industry of being really radical and innovative on the way they bring technology to banking. They're really at the forefront of actually figuring out here's how banking is evolving, and we want to be leading that charge. So you don't have to be a kind of cool, hip Silicon Valley type company to be going, we can do great work. You can actually be big. You can be small. You can be a conservative culture. You can be a different type of culture. It's about getting clear about, of everything we could do, what might have the most impact? What's the work that has impact and meaning, kind of speaks to our values as an organization or as individuals? And how do we have the courage to pursue that?
Yeah, no, I mean, it totally makes sense. And what I'm trying to really get my arms around is how do you get people to buy into that? I mean, because when you see the numbers, I mean, you see where people are at in terms of their job satisfaction and so on. How as a leader, do you get people to buy into the notion of don't just scrape by, man, you know, just like actually do really great work here? How do you make that happen?
Well, there's a few ways of doing it. And one of the key ways is helping people remember when they have done great work before. So they get that sense of almost longing to kind of reconnect to that. You know, one of the things we do in our workshops is we will have people pair up and tell each other a time, a story of a time when they've done great work before. And we don't give them long. It's like 3 or 4 minutes per person. So it's a quick story. But it is so cool in that moment because you go, your classroom, there's 500 people there. They're paired up talking to somebody they haven't met before. They start telling these stories. You see their kind of eyes start to sparkle. The energy in the room rises and people feel they've got this connection with each other. And then when you ask people, so what's it like telling a story of a time you did great work? People are like, it's engaging, it's amazing, it's inspiring. But it's also a little sad for some people because they go, I remember what that's like and I don't have enough of it now. Mm. So part of it is that kind of visceral getting into a what's in it for me? Why would you want to do great work? And then there's a way of saying, how do we actually make this part of what we're trying to achieve as an organization? And here's a challenge. CEOs and senior leaders are actually brilliant at talking about great work all the time. We're going to do this. We're going to change that. We're going to be different from our competitors this way. All of those are calls to do great work. But where they run into trouble is that they go kind of whisper, oh, but by the way, all that good work you have, which you can never get done in a 48-hour working week, you have to get all that done. And by the way, when you innovate, when you do stuff you've never done before, you know, you need to do that perfectly. Don't screw up or else you'll be have a career damaging moment. And that's where the challenge lies, which is going, it's easy enough to reconnect why you'd want to do great work and even imagine what your great work might be and connect it to an organization's goals. What's hard is fighting the status quo that good work brings, the patterns of behavior, the old habits, the old expectations. Because at the heart of doing more great work is that strategy question we mentioned before the break. If you're going to say yes to this, what are you going to say no to? Mm-hmm. And the challenges of saying no to a what is actually saying no to a person. And that's where the courage piece lies. That's where the resilience piece really comes forward.
Yeah. Richie?
I was just going to say, it seems as if doing great work too, although it could have results quickly, it seems like it's more of a long play overall who we are as like morally
then, how we're wired, yeah.
You know, than necessarily looking at the numbers all the time.
Yeah, for sure. And you have less certainty of success. I mean, think about good work, because you've done it before, because you know how it works, because you've got systems and processes and profit margins and all that sort of stuff built into it. It's far more predictable. But over time, good work becomes commoditized. It becomes less valuable. It makes less money, whatever it might you're after. When you're doing great work, there's that degree of we're rolling the dice here. Maybe this is going to work. Maybe it won't work. If it doesn't work, what's the culture around here about how we learn from failure, whether we, you know, fire somebody or whether we promote somebody? So there's more risk involved in that. So you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, when you go to or the CEOs or whomever hires you, human resources or marketing, I mean, how do they articulate that they want to elevate their employees' work or creativity? Do you know what I mean? Because on yeah. such a big scale, how are they knowing what they really need for their organization?
Yeah, so you have to start with what the organization's looking for. So sometimes they come and they go, look, we need something just to get people excited. We've got a whole bunch of people here in the room. We need something that will bring them together and bring focus to what we're doing. And we're doing a strategic retreat, our yearly strategy plan. And this bad work, good work, great work is actually, in some ways, the simplest of strategic models. You know, what's the mixed combination of good work and great work that we're going to strive for to be strategically savvy this year? So sometimes it's a strategic need. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's an engagement need. People are like, you know what? We kind of suck at engaging people. How are we going to do something about that? And actually taking it down to good work and great work, particularly if you have people working in teams, that can be a really powerful way to drive engagement. And then there are other times, Mary, when it's about productivity, where they're like, you know what, we're doing okay, but we've got to lift the impact we do because, you know, we've all had the experience of looking around our organization going, I'm pretty sure 80% of what we do here makes no difference whatsoever. So how do we get rid of that and focus on the stuff that really does make a difference? So there are different doorways that you can go in, but people have found that that simple model, bad work, good work, and great work, can be a useful way of accessing things that matter to the business.
Awesome. All right. Well, Michael, we're going to have to do this. We're going to have to wrap up here, man. Really do appreciate you joining us. If you want more information on Michael Bungerstunier. Oh man, I think I'm close. I'm close to that. But if you want more information on Michael and all the fun stuff that he's doing and the great work that he's doing in the world, check out boxofcrayons.biz. So again, that is boxofcrayons.biz. Awesome having you on, my man. Really do appreciate you joining us. For those of you who have been subscribing and rating and reviewing and sharing the show with your friends, we really, really do appreciate that. If you want to join in on the conversation, you can hit us at 1-844-MR-BOLD-1. That's 1-844-MR-BOLD-1. Leave us your comments and questions. Mary Goulet, Rich Ote, I'm Steve Ulsher, and we will talk to you guys next time here on Reinvention Radio.
You just got dismantled. Thanks for listening to Reinvention Radio. For more information about the show and your host, Steve Ulsher, visit reinventionradio.com.
One person has the power to change the world, impact millions of lives, and leave a legacy for lifetimes to come. That person is you. In the New York Times bestseller, What is Your What?, Steve Ulsher, award-winning author and founder of the Reinvention Workshop, reveals his proven process that has helped thousands of men and women discover, share, and monetize the one thing they were born to do. Grab your free copy now at www.whatisyourwhat.com/free. That's www.whatisyourwhat.com/free.